Tonight, we return to the Alexander Brothers verdict, but the story begins and ends where prosecutors say it always should have, and that is with the survivors, the victims of the Alexander Brothers. Now, after a Manhattan jury convicted Tall, Oren, and Alone Alexander on all 10 counts, federal prosecutors came out and said the case was only possible because 11 women came forward and told their stories in court. A direct quote from the statement from the government here: evidence and testimony from 11 brave victims demonstrated that the Alexander brothers conspired to repeatedly lure, drug, and the R word with young women.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, STS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the global phenomenon, bringing you the very best guests in all of true crime. Tonight, we're going to try to focus on where the focus should be here, and that's with the survivors, the victims here of the Alexander brothers. And boy, that number has really racked up since the first couple of civil lawsuits, with now over 60 accusers. There's going to be a lot of fallout after Tuesday's sweeping guilty verdict in the very high profile federal sex trafficking trial of the Alexander brothers. Tonight, we're going to break down some of the voices of the victims. Why the brothers? Why did they never take a plea deal, or at least attempt to really work on one? I don't know that the government was that flexible, but we'll discuss it anyway. Also, there's talk now and some reporting already about a possible presidential pardon and what lies ahead with sentencing, civil lawsuits, and possible state charges. And no one better to sort of get us caught up to speed than our first guest here, Eric Fudali, a partner and managing attorney at the Bloom Firm in New York City. He does represent victims in high-profile civil litigation, and he is representing a victim on the civil side as it relates to the Alexander brothers. So thank you for being here, Eric, and we will break that down in just a moment. Next up, Dr. Joni Johnson, a forensic psychologist, a private investigator, a crime writer. She's worked both inside medium and maximum security prisons. She also has a book, Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask. And she hosts a YouTube channel, Unmasking a Murderer. Next up, we've got four tonight, a little unusual. Randy Zellin, criminal defense out of New York City. He got a couple of boos the last time because we had him on during the trial. And defense attorneys, that's what they do. They defend clients. And so we're going to see what he has to say now that there is a conviction here. Randy also was a former prosecutor and teaches law at Cornell School of Law. Last but not least, you got R.J. Dreeling, a former senior prosecutor for Los Angeles County, where he handled a lot of high-profile cases, including prosecuting sex crimes cases. And now he's in the world of criminal defense. Thank you to each and every one of you. Eric, let me start with you, which is where we should start. Your client, who is a survivor of the Alexander brothers, how is she doing? What was her reaction to the verdict here?
Well, certainly she's thrilled with the verdict. You know, it was a long trial and very difficult for her to sort of watch from afar, as she was not one of the witnesses who are part of the criminal trial. She's a separate civil trial against the Alexander brothers. But her allegations are similar to those that were alleged in the criminal trial, in that they are based on the TVPA, the sex trafficking law against two of the Alexander brothers. But she was very relieved, I think, is probably the best word to describe. It's also very empowering for her. And I would say most of all, validating to see a jury of their peers, a Manhattan jury, believe these 11 very brave survivors who were so courageous to testify against rows and rows and rows and teams of defense attorneys in front of the jury. So it's very validating to see that, A, the jury believed these women, but from my perspective, also very important that the jury understood the nuances of the sex trafficking law. the TVPA is not the most easy law to explain to a jury, not the most easy law. Oftentimes jury hears about sex trafficking. They think, you know, the movie Taken or something along those lines. And that's not really how it's been applied in the United States, especially in the civil arena. So really, you know, sort of very happy, very proud of the women who testified, very validated and very empowered, and looking forward to being able to prove our case now in civil court.
Yeah, and I want to just, you know, Eric has to be kind of careful with what he says and what he can reveal, but we'll circle back and I've got more questions for you about that. But RJ, to you, I mean, you prosecuted sex crimes cases. With this victory, it's obviously often very difficult for victims to come forward. Many started to after a couple of civil suits were filed. But now with this victory, would you expect to see additional civil suits, additional victims come forward, and maybe not just related to the Alexander brothers, but also the people in their, you know, in their world, people that they associated with, because already some names have been thrown out there.
Yeah, you really got to hand it to the prosecutors in this case. Anytime you have allegations of sexual abuse against high profile, powerful individuals with a lot of money, one of the hardest things that you can do is to get the victims to come forward, and not even just come forward and interview, but agree to testify in front of those people in a high profile, high publicity case. So it's not just about necessarily about the evidence and being in court. It's about collecting the victims together, empowering them to speak in front of the jury, and getting them to speak in a way that the jury understands the nuances and the complicated legal issues that you've been talking about. So you really got to hand it to prosecutors. And I would expect that after a successful case like this, where they feel heard, where they feel seen, and where ultimately the jury agreed with what they were saying, that you would see other victims come forward against potentially other high-profile people, other powerful people, or even more allegations against these brothers themselves.
Every once in a while, it just mutes me. I guess it doesn't like me. There's a little, RJ, if you don't mind, can you just keep yourself muted while you're not speaking, if it's not too much of a problem? Because I think there's a little bit of an audio glitch. There should be a mute button that's fairly obvious. I can try to help you there. There we go. I got it for you. Joni, you know, Eric's representing a victim. We've had a victim on here. We just got a victim statement the night of the verdict. It's got to be incredibly difficult for these survivors. What do you think is going like through their collective mind, having this resounding victory with a lot of people doubting them, and some people doubting, to Eric's point, whether the jury would get the instructions here and get it right?
I can only imagine the emotions that they're experiencing. I mean, I started out my career working with victims of sexual violence and physical abuse with children as well as with adults. And there's so much of the secondary trauma. There's the initial injury, and then there's all the doubt and the victim blaming and all the things that go on in the system that just compound the problem. And I think that a lot of the victims hopefully are feeling like they were for the first time perhaps heard. And also not just thinking about themselves and their own healing, but thinking about the fact that they are setting, you know, an example for other women who might be in a similar situation. I've had so many victims say that I would never have gone through with it if I didn't think that it would help somebody down the road prevent this from happening or allow them a path to getting some kind of justice.
Thank you for that, Joni. Randy, to you, this is obviously a very tough position for any criminal defense attorney to be in, and they had an army of them. But if you are representing the Alexander brothers, what do you say to them after a massive defeat? How do you keep their morale up to tell them, hey, we're going to try to fight this in an appellate court? But we all know that is a very, very big uphill battle, Randy.
Which is exactly why what you just said, and it's fortuitous in terms of having four of us, I can keep my answers extremely short. There's really nothing that you can do. You probably hope that you don't get fired because someone will come in and second guess everything that you have done. So you play it down the middle. You have a sentencing left to do. You will fight like hell for the minimum mandatory, which is 180 months. You will fight like hell in terms of institutional placement and put you in a place where you won't get killed, because this ain't exactly a great crime to brag about when you're in. And we'll look at all of the appellate issues, including the fact that you had all of these women and come in and testify where it should have been one woman, one case at a time.
Interesting. That we'll get back to, and I'm going to take a note on that. Randy, just back to you. So I kind of have a bone to pick with one of the attorneys, and that's a guy named Howard Shrebnick, who's from Miami. Just very acerbic, to me, very abrasive. The judge didn't love him. He was down. He's from here. He was Roy Black's partner until Roy Black passed away. But, you know, when I was talking to him down at federal court, when the brothers were dealing with federal court in Miami, and I mentioned the word accusers, he kind of stopped the whole media gaggle, turned to me. He was like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? These are just women up for a money grab. Well, now there's a conviction, and these quote unquote money grabbing non-accusers are survivors and they are victims. But it really just rubbed me the wrong way. You know, Mark Agnifilo is sort of a jovial character, a nice guy. But what about this issue when you're representing, and let's just call them what they are, disgusting, heinous, depraved defendants who were now convicted? As a defense attorney, wouldn't it benefit you to be a little more human, a little more empathetic, even if you're representing clients that are this disgusting?
Sure, but what's the fun in losing out on an opportunity to grab some attention for yourself, which I would respectfully submit was all that was happening there. There was absolutely no reason to victim crap on. There was no reason to do anything other than allow the world to see that you are a professional, and maybe a little bit of your civility and your professionalism will inure to your client's benefit.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And I know Randy Zellin would not rub me the wrong way. And I know, look, it's a very difficult job, and you've got to have criminal defense attorneys, even on cases like this. But I think that there's a certain modicum of behavior that is would be appreciated by the public. And maybe, by the way, we reached out to Howard Shrebnick, who has not responded to us, and I'm not expecting him to, but he's got a platform on the show. Would love to talk to him. He's probably a pretty good debater.
There's another client out there that digs that style, mm-hmm. and that's the audience that you play to.
Yeah, that's exactly what someone said, Randy, that some clients want that. They want this brash. You know, he's got the brash New York thing, even though he's from Miami, but to each his own, just not my style, I guess. But Eric, let me just read some of what the government said yesterday in their statement here. They said evidence and testimony from 11 brave victims demonstrated that the Alexander brothers conspired to repeatedly lure, drug, and R young women. We don't say the word on YouTube. We commend the victims for their courage in coming forward and testifying at trial. They bravely overcame the pain of reliving the abuses inflicted upon them, and concluded with a broader message here. This verdict cannot undo the harm suffered by the victims, but it sends a message that sex trafficking will not be tolerated. Is that message powerful enough, in your opinion?
I hope so. I agree with everything that came from that prosecutor statement. I think that was really well said. And I do hope, you know, very sincerely, that this is sort of bigger than the Alexander brothers, especially when you compare, juxtapose it with the way this Epstein issue has been handled. I represent 11 victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Of course, I represent an accuser of the Alexander brothers. And to see the way that these sort of have differently been handled, where on one side you see with Epstein, you see the message to the world or the United States of America that if you are rich and powerful, you know, you will get away with it. Worst case scenario, you'll end up in a minimum secure, you know, resort style, you know, prison. But now here with the Alexander brothers, you have other very powerful, very wealthy, very influential males who did not get away with it, who were convicted of sex trafficking, who were tried, who were brought in front of a jury of their peers, had 11 women bravely stand up against them, and were convicted and will very likely, you know, face a very severe sentence. So I think, and I hope the message is larger than the Alexander brothers, that there are not necessarily two tiers of justice, or three tiers if you're friends with Donald Trump, but that there can be accountability, there can be justice And I hope this message to other women who are perhaps suffering in silence or are afraid or not yet feeling empowered enough to stand up to their abuser, whether that person is high profile or not. I hope this sends a message that justice is available. There can be accountability and to not suffer in silence and to come forward and to make that accusation against your abuser, because justice can happen.
And thank you for the work you're doing. I think it's really important. And I don't know that you guys get enough credit on your side for helping these victims. Joni, I'm coming back to you, I promise. But RJ, to you, on the issue of sex trafficking, you know, in light of Sean Diddy Combs, and that was a RICO charge that they had trouble with. But a lot of people were talking about, well, I wonder if this jury can get this right. It was six men, six women. I wonder if they're going to understand the nuances of the law. And the defense, to their credit, was really picking at the minutia that makes up the law here. How tough is it, in your opinion, for a jury to kind of wrap their head around a sex trafficking charge versus, let's say, a SA or an R charge that rhymes with grape?
That's it's a great question. I think Randy would agree, no matter what side you're on, prosecutor or defense, if you have the facts, you argue the facts. If you have the law, you argue the law. And the facts were tremendously on the prosecution side. And once they heard from all these people testifying about the brutal conduct that was now not longer alleged, but has been proven, everything else, generally speaking, on a case like that is going to fall into place. And I think once they hear about people being trafficked, being drugged, being taken advantage of, and being, you know, the R word, as you said, it really becomes an extremely high uphill battle for the defense at that point to start arguing the legal minutia in that case. When the jury hears things like this, when they hear how long it's been going on for, how many women were involved, the kind of egregious nature of the conduct, you know, they're really going to be inclined to want to convict these people. And I think what I kind of alluded to earlier, the real struggle in the prosecution was getting everyone together, bringing them to court and empowering them to speak. And that's certainly going to be a source of appeal, I'm sure, is picking apart whether or not these exact charges lined up with the law, whether that everything that was brought before the court matches up with what the jury instructions were. So I expect they'll pick that apart on appeal. But as far as cases like this, where the facts are really profound and very disturbing, the law on the prosecution side just kind of falls into place after that. Mm.
Thank you. And I'll have you just remain. Thank you. Just, yeah, if you can keep it muted. Joni, I had a different question for you, but STS Nation is always on the ball, and they have this question for you. Joni, Dr. Johnston to me, but I'll call you Joni. What about these women now? Will they receive any help or direction that they need to go to be healthy in their lives? I mean, what do you do? You know, you get a victory, you get a modicum of justice, but you're still a victim to the crime and you still have to go on with your life. So how do you pick up the pieces?
You do. And I think, you know, a lot of these women have gone on with their lives for years, right? After this has happened. So this is not like something that's new for them, but I do think that this will be incredibly healing. Just the verdict and the support that they've gotten, and that the fact that a jury listened to these women and believed them, and decided that the, you know, perpetrators in this case were going to receive what they deserved, is going to be healing. It doesn't mean, though, psychologically, as you're talking about, that there aren't a lot of things to navigate. You know, not only the fact that many of them, you know, have been traumatized over and over again, not just by the perpetrators, but by the system. And they're going to have to navigate that. But what I think, when you look at people who've undergone trauma, I think getting that justice is one huge thing. And I think having support is huge. You know, it's hard to even talk about what's better and what's more healing than the support of your community and support and knowing that people believe you. And hopefully that many of them, if they feel a need to get mental health services, they'll have access to that and they will do that. But I can't, you know, I really can't overemphasize how important this verdict was, not just for what happened from a justice point of view, but from a healing point of view to get that verdict.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Randy, here's a question. I was going to play some video, which I'll do right after you answer this. But why was the case in New York in the Southern District, if they live in Florida, and it went through the federal system down here for a very short time? Some of the brothers did live in New York, but why New York and not Florida for federal?
Well,
From a jurisdictional standpoint, it's relatively easy to establish jurisdiction if you want to. And certainly when you're talking about the element of this being a federal case, so you've got the interstate commerce, you've got the crossing of state lines, you're going to have women going back and forth. They may be out in the Hamptons, they may be in Florida, they may be in Manhattan, and it may simply have been a matter of that the Southern District of New York had an appetite for this case, had the bodies to put on it, to prosecute the case, and had the willingness to throw the resources at the case. And that's why they do call the Southern District of New York the Yankee Stadium of all of the districts in the country.
Mm. By the way, speaking of New York City, we lost an absolute legend in broadcasting. Ernie Anastas is gone, and I had the distinct honor of calling him a colleague and a friend. I'm going to talk about him a little bit at the end of the show. The COE is going to pull up some video. But speaking of the Yankees, he was sort of the Babe Ruth of New York City broadcasting. And COE, if we can pull up, I see the photo, but I love to play a little bit of video because it's hard to capture Ernie without video. But this, Randy Zellin, is Mark Agnifilo, who represented Diddy. And he was also the criminal defense, one of them in this case. This is courtesy of Daniel Mail down here in Florida, who has this on his YouTube page. And I hope he's OK with me grabbing it from him. But this is Mark Agnifilo after court yesterday. And the silence as he speaks between words is sort of telling.
So just very quick, thank you all for covering the trial. Obviously not the verdict we were looking for, but we're going to keep fighting. There are a lot of avenues open to us. We're not going to stop. We believe in our client's innocence, and we're not going to stop fighting until we prevail, and we believe that we will one day prevail. Today was not the outcome we were looking for, obviously, but it just... our resolve is unshaken. We're going to keep representing them, and we believe that we will prevail in the future, although that day was not today. So that's all I have to say. If there's a couple of questions, I'm cool.
Mark, how did the brothers take the verdict? As we saw their heads were down, they were shaking their heads. And then second, what issues, if any, have you identified already in terms of appealable issues?
So I'll answer the first one. Listen, we're all disappointed with the verdict. In terms of appellate issues, we believe we have many appellate issues. We've objected repeatedly during the trial. We've preserved those issues. We believe they have merit, but this isn't the forum for that. We'll raise them at the appropriate time. So I'm not going to take too many questions. I just wanted to talk to you because you've all been patient and waiting. And so that's all I have. And thank you all very much.
Thank you. When you say that's all I have, that's really all you have. But Randy, I'm sure you've been in this position. They're not going to stop. They're going to prevail. I believe in their innocence. Something tells me Mark is a very smart man, that he doesn't believe in their innocence quite that much. Is that all he could do right there?
Well, let me address the latter point, Joel. And I think it's critically important that the world understand that when you are a criminal defense attorney, the question of guilt or innocence, it's not an issue. If you want to judge your client, go get a black robe and become a judge. All we do as criminal defense attorneys, we follow the evidence. We look to create that reasonable doubt. We look to get the best result that we can for a client. Your viewers may be wondering, if this case was such a slam dunk for the government, why wasn't there a plea deal negotiated? And the simple answer to that is that one of the differences between federal practice and state practice is that in federal practice, you don't get to go to a judge and say, hey, judge, talking to the government, I think we have a deal on the table. What are you prepared to do for us in terms of a sentence if we take a plea? You are prohibited 99 times out of 100. From doing that in a federal case. You don't know what the sentence is until the judge opens the judge's mouth. So oftentimes it's like, hey, I got a client with money. I got a client with nothing to lose. He's looking at a minimum mandatory 180 months. Let's let's push our chips in. But as far as Mark goes, there's nothing more that Mark could have said than what he said. And again, he's not sitting there saying, ah, these guys are guilty of sin. He's not saying, oh, they're innocent as all hell. It's like, I got a client and I am going to do the best that I can for my client. That is my job.
And Randy, one other quick one here. So Valerie Caproni, her honor is apparently very tough. I don't know if you've argued in front of her or not. And apparently she's very tough when it comes to sentencing. What do you expect sentencing here to be?
Well, one of the nice things about federal criminal practice and federal criminal sentencing, when I have to answer a question like yours, it's a numbers crunching game. Everything you do in a federal case carries with it, for lack of a better way, of points. The crime that you commit carries with it points. What you did carries with it points. The number of victims carries with it points. All kinds of things, and you become like an accountant, and you number crunch, and you add up all the numbers, and if you take a plea, you get to subtract some numbers. If you didn't have a terribly large role in it, you get to subtract some numbers, and you add up the numbers, and then you go to a chart, and you look at the chart, and the chart gives you a range in months. Here, they're not going to get anything knocked off. They are looking at a minimum mandatory 180 months. Is it likely that the judge is going to give them that? No, it's not likely. Federal judges, unlike state judges, however, don't tax a defendant for going to trial. There's nothing called a trial tax where you get punished for exercising your constitutional right to say, prove my guilt. But yeah, these brothers are, if they're lucky, will come out walking and not come out feet first.
I mean, give me a guesstimate here. We're talking 30 years, 40 years, 25, 60. Give me a number.
I would say 11 victims, assuming that the judge doesn't stack and run consecutive sentences and basically looks at as one overarching scheme. I would say somewhere between 20 and 25. So we split the baby and let's call it whatever 22 and a half years is times 12 months to get that number of months.
Interesting. The sentencing, by the way, is August 6th, and there will be survivors there to speak. Eric, I know you're kind of limited, but you know, number one, this is a very victim, you know, survivor focused show. Even has the name in there. So please tell, you know, your client that we are sending our best also to the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and other horrific crime or set of crimes there. But I mean, what if anything, can you tell us about your client? I mean, how reluctant was she to come forward? You know, what prompted her to come forward? Has she gained confidence over time, and how is she doing now? You know, any of these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to answer those questions. So my client is someone who has been suffering in silence for quite some time. And it was the bravery, it was the courageousness of the other women who have come forward in this case, both by filing civil lawsuits and, of course, very bravely being witnesses in the criminal case, you know, testifying in front of rows of defense attorneys or a jury. That is what inspired and empowered my client, Tiffany, to decide to come forward and take those steps to confront what she alleges happened and to no longer, you know, be suffering in silence. And I think that was a really profound thing for her. And it's something I see in my cases all the time. You know, I represent women all the time against very high profile individuals. And I often see what's often referred to as collective empowerment, where one woman will step forward or one victim will step forward against a high profile individual. And you'll see sort of a domino effect of other women, other victims step forward, not just against that alleged perpetrator, but also against their abuser or their, you know, the person that trafficked them or the person that, you know, assaulted them. That's what they, you know, it's a really sort of profound phenomenon that I see all the time. So I think that's what really encouraged her. It was seeing the bravery of other women take on and have the ability, you know, have the courageousness to take on extremely powerful wealthy individuals. You know, they each brother seemed to have his own private defense team. They were really, I mean, I represent an accuser of Diddy as well. So I spent a lot of time at the Sean Diddy Combs trial, and it mirrored that. I mean, rows and rows and rows of defense attorneys is really not easy to testify in front of, especially when you're talking about the most traumatic part of, you know, incident in your life. You're talking about very intimate details, very embarrassing details. So I commend those women. And the other thing is, you know, I'll add is that my client was so empowered and felt so brave that she actually even used her real name in the lawsuit, which is not something she had to do. She could have come out as a Jane Doe, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with using a pseudonym. Many women choose that. Many victims choose that to protect their identity. All of my Epstein clients, for instance, have chosen to, you know, proceed under a pseudonym. But yeah, really courageous of her to really stand up and say, you know, I'm not intimidated by your power or your money or your wealth. And I'm going to step forward. I'm going to tell my story. And I'm very proud to represent her and look forward to proving her case in court as we move forward.
And please let her know, and all your other clients who are victims of these types of cases, if they need a platform, and our platform has grown to be pretty large, it is theirs rent free. They're more than welcome, but obviously it has to be the right time for them. I'm curious, when you know, you said you were in court a lot for the Diddy trial. I was there for the first week. But from your perspective, handling these civil cases, I'm just curious, when you're at the criminal case, what sorts of things are you looking at or taking note of for your own cases?
Right. So there's a few things. So in the Diddy case, I represent Dawn Richard, who has very public allegations against Mr. Combs. And she was actually a witness in that case. So part of my being there was, of course, you know, supporting her, being there for her questioning and support and, you know, and that sort of thing. But beyond sort of specifically to be there in support of a witness, you're really looking at how the defense presents the case. You want to see, you know, what are their defenses? How are they trying to undermine? Are they going to victim shame? Are they going to attack the credibility of the victims? Are they going to really more so rely on the law and the nuances of the sex trafficking law, which, you know, as I'm sure Randy would agree, you know, sex trafficking has a lot of different questions you have to answer yes to for there to be a guilty verdict. Prosecutors always want there to be one, maybe two questions. Defense attorneys like more and more questions. Sex trafficking is one of those where there's a lot of questions a jury has to check yes to in order to get a conviction. So you want to see how the defense attorneys are going to attack the law, attack the verdict form, and what their strategies are going to be. And also you want to watch the prosecution and learn from maybe, you know, their successes and perhaps even their mistakes. I thought the prosecution did a very nice job in both cases, both Combs and certainly this Alexander Brothers case. So it's a lot of that. It's being there in support of your clients, whether they're there or not. It's learning from the defense. It's learning from the prosecution, and ultimately learning how a jury digested all these things. And that's been the most important thing and the most enlightening thing from this Alexander Brothers trial as I move toward my civil trial, which is that the jury got it. The jury understood the nuances of the TVPA, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. Not only did they understand it, but they bought it. And then they applied these facts that you would not typically in our lives, you know, our normal lives, consider sex trafficking or equate to sex trafficking. But when you actually look at the letter of the law and the case law and the way it's been expanded, are very much in line with the TVPA. So I'm really happy to see that the jury understood it and applied it correctly.
And this particular case, will it go to trial, do you think, or will there be some sort of deal cut?
It's too early to tell. As you mentioned, there's apparently very many allegations in civil cases right now pending against the Alexander brothers. We're very early on. We're still in the pleading stage of our lawsuit. So it's very early to tell. It is a federal lawsuit filed in Miami. So, you know, as you know, federal cases typically move closer and often more likely to go to trial based on a more condensed timeline. However, at this stage, it's very, very early to know whether or not this will go all the way to trial. I, of course, am a trial attorney, and I look forward to trying cases. However, sometimes, you know, early resolution is in the best interest of the client. And that's, of course, the most important thing.
Yeah. Dr. Joni, to you, from Norma, she has one question. How sick you have to be to do what these brothers did. But my question to you, Joni, you had 11 different women testifying, really from 11 different worlds, not necessarily connected to one another, telling very similar stories. And then the government called it, you know, the predator playbook. What does it tell you about the quote unquote perpology here? What does it tell you about these brothers and this behavior, and they're acting like this for, you know, years, over, you know, years and decades period of time?
I mean, it's a pretty remarkable set of circumstances or set of facts. I mean, it's just in terms of just as somebody who's been around individuals who've been traumatized, I have to say this is such an extreme case, not just in terms of the amount of time that this went on, the fact that these men were so young when it started, the fact they're just the kind of joining together and kind of collaborating. And, you know, they have these three men who are just engaging in all this incredibly disruptive and traumatic and just horrific behavior. There's just, I mean, and there's so many parts of his, of their, you know, their behavior. It's not just about dominance and control, which we talk about the R word. We're always talking about that. But there's such a sense of contempt for these women that kind of borders on sadistic, you know, kind of acts. So it really is an extreme, I think, example of.
Joni, let me hop in there because, you know, one of the biggest cases, our quote unquote OG case was Dan Markell and the Adelsons. And in that family, you've got the Adelson family, the brother Charlie convicted, the mother Donna convicted. Most people thinking that both the husband, Harvey, had something to do with it, and even the daughter, the ex-wife, Wendy. And then you've got this one sweet angel of a brother, Rob Adelson, who testified against his family. And in this case, you've got someone named Neve Alexander, which seems to be the only decent human being in the family, living, from what I understand, a normal life, you know, married, working. What happened in this family dynamic?
That is a huge question. I mean, I've given it some thought myself. I know that that Neve is, what, 5 or 6 years older. And then you have these three, you know, three other siblings or three other brothers who were like less than a year apart. And it just seems to me that, you know, there's just such a dramatic difference in terms of here is this older brother who seems to kind of have his life somewhat together, you know, is relatively successful. And then you have these three brothers who are about a year apart who seem to have developed this kind of almost like a deviant subculture between the three of them, and then kind of rope other people into this. And so it's hard to kind of know exactly what all has gone on. I guess obviously it's more than just an age difference. But certainly you see a completely different outcome between these three men. And the other thing that really struck me is the fact that you have these three brothers who are engaging in all this behavior together. It really does remind me of the old, you know, the old statement about the sum is greater than its parts. Because I think you have these three people who literally just escalated and kind of collaborated together and reinforced each other, and things escalated and got worse and worse and worse. And it was part of the bonding thing for them, I think.
Bonding in a really odd way, considering.
Exactly. In a very deviant way.
Yeah. I mean, Orin and Alone would literally, since they're twins, would switch on the women. Just crazy stuff. RJ, to you, and Randy sort of alluded to it, but a question that came up yesterday was, why did these brothers work harder to cut some sort of deal with the government? Is it just because the government wasn't offering any deal, or there was no wiggle room there? What's your best guess?
You know, in a high profile case like this, where the conduct is extremely serious, extremely disturbing, it spans a long period of time. There's going to be the prosecutor oftentimes isn't even going to make an offer. They're just going to look at the defense attorney and say, if you want to cut a deal, you or plead to the judge in federal court, you can do it. And as Randy said, in federal court, there's often very little incentive to try to cut a deal before the trial. So my guess is this is a high profile case. You had very serious allegations over a very long period of time that the prosecutor from the outset knew they weren't going to try to cut a deal. They were going to go to trial and get every day they could out of the Alexander brothers. I have virtually no doubt about that.
Randy, do you agree with that?
It's difficult to disagree with it. Although, if you want to flip the coin, if you are a government prosecutor, and as my colleagues tonight have talked about the difficulty in stitching together multiple victims, when you're talking about, and I'm a man, so I can't for one second relate to what it's like to be a woman. But for a woman to have to bare her soul, the most intimate, just shameful, horrific details for the world to see, and to get those women to agree to come forward. And as the trial gets closer and gets closer, will they actually be there at 9 o'clock in that courthouse ready to go. And I've seen instances where at the last minute, I can't do it. I just can't do it. So there is an incentive if you're a prosecutor to avoid putting these women through that hell all over again, to avoid, you never know, there could be one holdout juror for whatever the reason who doesn't convict. And now you've got to do this all over again. Things happen in a trial. So there's a reason why if you can resolve a case, you can resolve it, even when it's high profile. But I do think that when all is said and done, it was simply a matter of federal prosecutors don't bargain away facts the way state prosecutors do. They're going to negotiate a deal, but that deal will be based upon what the top provable count is factually. And since you can't go to a judge and get a sentencing commitment where a judge can undercut a prosecutor for the sake of getting something to go away, if you have a client with the resources, what the hell? They'll never be able to spend the money again. So they might as well throw it at their day in court.
Randy, I just want to come back to you on this because this is getting a lot of people responding to it. There's a guy named Rob Shooter who has a Substack, independent journalist called Naughty But Nice. And he on the Substack late last night published that from someone who is, quote unquote, an insider, saying these guys have spent years in the same luxury real estate world as Trump and his allies. They know a lot of the same developers, investors, and power brokers. And according to this guy, Rob Shooter, they're already angling for some kind of presidential pardon. Pointed out that Julian Todd Chrisley, they got a presidential pardon. NBA Youngboy got a presidential pardon from Donald Trump. You know, I guess living and working in the same circles as the Kushners, etc. What sort of legitimate shot do these despicable human beings have of getting a presidential pardon from President Trump? And I would imagine it would reflect very poorly on the president to let people like this go.
You answered the question just now, Joel. So again, in the interest and the economy of time, I can't add to anything you just said.
I mean, is there a shot you think he'll do it or no? I mean, realistically.
There's always a shot. There was conversations about Mr. Combs getting a pardon. There were conversations about Ghislaine Maxwell getting a pardon. We haven't seen any of those things happen. So I think, again, that's another example of someone looking for those 5, 10, 15 minutes of fame. And as Post Malone likes to say, it's all hat, no cattle.
Eric, I mean, please add to that. So Melissa says this is why we need state charges and they're supposed to face state charges. Do you see a scenario where the president pardons these three brothers? I mean, it seems like political suicide to me, but what do I know?
Yeah, I mean, the thought's horrifying, but I will go back to, you know, Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. He was asked very directly if he's considering a pardon for Ghislaine Maxwell. He didn't rule it out. And I've been on many television shows, and podcasts where I've been banging my head on the table about the fact that any reasonable human being would hear the question, are you considering a pardon for a convicted child sex trafficker like Ghislaine Maxwell? The answer would be, of course not. She's a convicted child sex trafficker. Why would he even consider a pardon for someone like that? So the fact that he never ruled it out, he said, I got to look into it. I'd look into it or something like that. I think he reminded everyone that he has the power to do it if he wants, as he often does. It was really horrifying to me and horrifying, to the victim. So I think, like Randy, I would never say never. I have no idea why or what incentive Donald Trump would have for pardoning convicted sex traffickers, especially beyond, based on the criticism he's received for how his administration and the Department of Trust has handled the Epstein case and how they've dealt with that sex trafficking ring. I can't imagine he would have any. He would think that it's good political, currency for him to pardon three brothers who were convicted of sex trafficking, 11 victims. But unfortunately, I think, it's almost the reality we're in is I unfortunately can't rule out that he would do that.
Yeah, well, I have a modicum of relief from you after hearing you say that you don't think it's going to happen. I really hope it does not happen. Dr. Joni, to you, in almost every instance, I think in every instance, at least just about every instance, these 11 victims talked about having a drink and then becoming incapacitated. literally blacking out. There's video of a 17-year-old girl who's, you know, there's an argument about whether she's underage. In my book, she's underage, whether or not it's legal consent. What about this aspect of it, that they would, you know, kind of seize on this opportunity and literally drug the women? It goes from, you know, bad to worse, and the depravity level just increases. But what is it psychologically that fueled these brothers to literally drug women?
I really do believe that these were men who saw women as objects. I mean, and not just objects, but just like toys in a way, because there's just no regard for them at all. It's almost like they're doing whatever they want to do separate from caring about anything besides themselves. And it's just it is hard to get our head around the fact that you have these individuals who have plenty of money, plenty of success, monetary success, and yet what they're getting off on are you know, creating these situations where people are helpless and being abused and have no power. Not having power is not even in the realm of what we're talking about. You know, that these individuals are literally getting satisfaction out of drugging young women. And the fact that it started, I think, 20 years ago. And I mean, it's hard to kind of get our head around. It really, at least hard for me to get my head around, to think that these kind of things would be going on. And like I said, the thing that just keeps coming back for me is just the utter contempt that these three men showed toward these young women. And the fact that, you know, that they would want to have that kind of power where they literally are drugging women. And that's what's turning them on. Like I said, it is pretty mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. And Joni, here's a question that's important. Tal's wife already has filed for divorce. The other two are married. They all have very young children. What do you say to the wives and now the ex-wife? I mean, they've now got to live not just in shame and humility, but also with the spawn, the children of these cretins. They've got to live and raise these children. As a psychologist, how do you even begin to, you know, consult with them and give them therapy on this?
Yeah, I think they're, you know, the wives are victims as well, although certainly not to the same extent that the women who experienced what they experienced did. So I think, you know, one of the things we do know is when you have situations like this, it's the ripple effect, right? It's the ripple effect of trauma. It's the ripple effect of accountability or lack thereof. And so I think when you talk about the women or the wives, you know, again, they're also victims in a way. So, you know, it's just something that is so big and so broad. I think that is really, and absolutely, these women have nothing to do with it other than they are also secondary victims. So I think, you know, hopefully we're going to start seeing some justice, not just in this case, but moving forward. And I think that's the best thing, obviously, that can come out of this.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, thank you, Joni. Eric, you know, there's like 60 civil suits filed, I believe, in Florida, a lot of them. But when do we expect to see movement with these civil suits in terms of either trials moving forward or damages being dispersed out? How does this all play out from your perspective?
It's a great question, and it's a hard question to answer. There's a lot of factors, obviously. You know, one of the bigger factors, though, sometimes there's often a stay during the criminal side of the case. I don't know if that was the case for the civil suits that were filed before the criminal case began. But now the criminal case is over. My understanding is there may be another criminal case, a state case in Florida, that they're going to be tried for pretty soon. I'm not really sure on the details on that. But, you know, hopefully soon. It's always in plaintiff's, you know, best interest. We're always trying to move the case forward as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. Defense attorneys typically try to slow it down. The good thing, my understanding is, because a lot of these lawsuits deal with sex trafficking, which is a federal law, a lot of these cases are in federal court. And for those who are unaware of the differences between state and federal court, especially in the civil arena, federal court goes much quicker. You will typically get a trial date after you filed your lawsuit within about a year, year and a half or so, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. Whereas in state court, it can take years and years and years to get to trial. So it is encouraging for plaintiff attorneys and the plaintiffs that there very likely will be more and quicker movement. It's typically a quicker discovery schedule. You're going to get the depositions of the brothers. They'll likely be in prison, but we'll take, you know, I'll take their deposition in prison. There will be discovery. There will be documents. There will be witnesses. It's hard to tell when sort of we're going to really see much update on that. In my case, again, we're at the pleading stage very early on. I assume there's going to be motions to dismiss and responses and that, you know, that whole process. So it's going to be a little bit before we really get to hit the ground and start doing discovery, taking depositions, interviewing witnesses or deposing witnesses. But it's my prerogative to move the case as quickly and expeditiously as possible.
And right now, these are all severed, separate cases, correct? Is there a chance that some of these cases get joined together?
Unlikely. It, you know, sometimes they're consolidated, at least the same judge, and sometimes the same judge will hear so that the decisions can sort of be consistent on the law and you don't have dueling decisions from the same courthouse or something along those lines. But I would be very unlikely. We would not try, as a plaintiff, would not try to join our cases with the other plaintiff's attorneys. And I can absolutely assure you that the defense attorneys would do everything they could in their power to avoid having multiple victims a part of the same civil trial. That's typically something, even when lawsuits are filed, you know, as two or three plaintiffs against one specific, you know, defendant, typically the defense attorneys will move and try very hard to get those trials separate. Mm.
Randy, this is the least of my worries, but I'm curious about this. From a financial standpoint, this is the father made a lot of money in his security business. The brothers then made a lot of money. But I do live in the land of milk and material goods here in Miami. Financially, what is going to happen to this family? I mean, they're paying enormous legal fees just to the Agnifilos of the world. But then they're about to get hit with a cascading avalanche of civil suits. What's going to be the end game here when all the dust settles? Where do these people end up financially? I'm talking about the family, the whole family, you know?
You move very quickly to amicably resolve your divorce. You give your wife everything. So this way, the wife and the children are okay. And then you leave it to the victims to try to claw all of that back after, which would be an additional year's worth of litigation. And that's what you do if you're worried about your family. It's a mean thing for me to suggest, but that is the cold and cruel reality. If you're going to spend the rest of your waking days behind bars where you're not going to need a lot of money except for your commissary and your perhaps phone privileges, and you're going to be making and banging out license plates, you might as well make sure that your children are taken care of and your lawyers are taken care of.
Wow. That is sobering right there. RJ, to you, the interesting question here on the same vein, will there be some freezing of assets, and are the parents liable through financial avenues as well? Will the parents get hit? What do you think happens?
So it's a great question. The, you know, we've seen kind of recently in criminal law, when we see these mass shootings, sometimes at schools, that the parents are starting to be held criminally liable for the actions of the kids. There's a famous case, I believe, out in Michigan, where that's exactly what happened. Yeah. So in order for the parents to be kind of, probably not criminally, but civilly liable in a case like this, there's going to be some kind of wrongdoing on the part of the parents. Were they enabling the conduct by giving money to their kids? Did they know what was going on and try to cover it up? So if there's some way for an attorney to prove that the parents knew what was going on, had a part in kind of enabling the behavior or covering it up or something like that, we could certainly see the parents on the hook. My suspicion is that the focus is going to be civilly on the brothers, but it's really possible if somewhere down the line someone gets some information that the parents were enabling the behavior, that they knew what was going on, that there was some kind of cover-up, they were trying to bury this, that they could face some kind of civil liability.
Wow. Garden Time with Frankenstein. I like the name. Shoot me an email, survivingthesurvivor@gmail.com. Alone was her boss or his boss at one point, I'm assuming her, at Kent Security. I'd be curious to talk to you if you want to shoot me an email. Randy, back to you real quickly. The three brothers, are they going to be housed together? I know the Menendez brothers, who are convicted murderers, were separated. How does a judge rule. I assume the brothers will want to be together because it's all they have. Will the judge allow this?
Well, when you talk about where you do your time, and I'm sure your viewers, as most people believe, that in a federal case, if you have money, you're going to end up at Club Fed, or if you're a woman, Camp Cupcake. There's a very complicated system based upon classifications. And when you're talking about crimes such as this, no, they're not going to be doing time at Club Fed. That's number one. Number two, they're not going to want to be in general population. There are certain crimes that you can wear on your sleeve when you're in jail. There are certain crimes where, okay, that's what you did, that's what you did. You do things to children, you do things to young women, particularly in the, just the, I don't even know what the right word is, the way that these men treated women as something less than playthings, something less than objects. That is nothing to be proud of. They will probably spend most of their time in something that looks like solitary confinement if they actually want to have some semblance of a life.
Joni, can you please add to that? You worked and still do, I think, in medium and maximum security prisons. This is going to be a federal prison, definitely not a camp. It's going to be a real federal prison. And these guys, I've said this on the air, I have two young daughters. If this happened to my daughters, I don't know that these guys would be having the opportunity to go to prison, because I might have ended up in prison myself, which is a way a lot of people feel. And then you get put into an inmate population, Joni, where people have young daughters, they have children. What is going to be their end game behind bars? Are they going to be paying a lot of money for security too?
Yeah, they will. I mean, I would certainly just piggyback on what Randy said, having worked inside a maximum security prison. I mean, it is not something to brag about. And there are lots of people in behind bars who have done lots of other things. But when it comes to wives, they think about their daughters, they think about their sisters, they think about their mothers. It's a whole different ballgame. And, you know, it's not uncommon for people to try to attack or hurt somebody like these brothers as kind of credibility or to get approval. And, you know, in prison. So they're going to have a tough road to hoe for sure. I mean, it's not going to be. And at least I'm not as familiar with the federal system as I am with the state system. But in the state system, it's all, you know, where you do your time is all dependent upon, you know, as Randy was saying, your classification. And you have very little say in what prison you go to. And you can be transferred tomorrow and have no idea why. Or where you're going. There's just no control over anything in your life, which is a whole nother thing to get used to once you're behind bars. I did want to just mention, if you don't mind, there was a question that came up that popped up that wasn't answered. I wanted to kind of address. It was, I think, directed toward me about the wives of the people who were convicted, the brothers. Yeah. Do they know? Do they believe, or do they think they're innocent? And that's an interesting question to answer, because in my experience, what happens with wives, either they believe it because they see the evidence relatively quickly, or they go through a period of denial where initially they don't. So most women that I've seen have been in situations, I can't say like this because it's not unprecedented, but it's just horrific. I think that there will be a time when they do believe this. I think the wild card sometimes are the children of the people who are behind bars, and sometimes the parents who hold on to that denial and refuse to believe kind of reality longer, I think, because of the different relationship they have with those individuals.
Now, I don't want to say we run in the same circles, but my wife and I have a lot of people we know who are friends of acquaintances of theirs. So no one I know is really friends with them, and no one has ever said a nice thing about any of these guys, but people know them because it's a small community. But apparently not only are the brothers absolutely incredulous, they're in shock that they were convicted. They can't believe it, but apparently the wives can't believe it either, from what I understand. I mean, that doesn't surprise you though, Joni?
It doesn't surprise me now. Like I said, I don't think it'll be that long. You said that a couple of them have filed for divorce. Maybe that's for financial reasons that Randy was saying, that they give their money to the wives and they file for divorce. I don't know what they're thinking. But I would be very surprised 5 years down the road if these wives are still feeling the same way and still believing the same things.
Yeah. RJ, to you, this is a, you know, a tougher question, but basically, again, just to underscore, and then we'll get some final thoughts in just a minute. But testimony from 11 different women, they all talked for the most part about text messages, digital evidence. There were multiple corroborating witnesses to the case. You know, you've been on both sides. The prosecution, obviously, I think, was an easier, an easier road to kind of hoe here. But is there anything the defense could have done differently, in your opinion, other than what they did, which is worked, you know, the law to the best of their ability? But it was definitely not enough.
You know, it was absolute from the outset. This was going to be a significant uphill battle for the defense. You had 11 different victims testifying to really egregious, really serious acts of violence. And you had a long time frame. You had that video that you talked about earlier. You had the sense of entitlement on behalf of the defense that came from a rich family. They were very rich themselves. From the outset, it was going to be an uphill battle. The facts weren't on the defense side, as I talked about earlier. The law was their really only hope, was trying to nitpick the law and whether the allegations fit within the crimes that were charged. It was going to be an uphill battle all the way through. It's very, you know, it's always easy to Monday morning quarterback this thing and say, well, maybe they should have been more aggressive or less aggressive. Maybe they should have focused on the law more or less. But in my experience with cases like this, where the conduct is this serious and you have a substantial number of victims coming forward, you have really serious conduct over a long period of time, it's always going to be an uphill battle for the defense. No matter who you hire, no matter how much money you spend, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Yeah, and I mean, with Diddy, you know, you always hear that 99.97% conviction rate. And when Diddy got off on some charges, I think people sort of lost, you know, a little faith just saying what happened. But
Diddy was the right guy, wrong case. And everybody knew that going in. Yeah. And it was a matter of just getting something. You can't take a case like that and turn it into a RICO case that he's running a criminal enterprise. You look at Diddy, most of the time he was watching. He was not actually having the sex. So really comparing Diddy's case to the Alexander's case really is apples and cement. I think you got the right result in the Diddy case and you got the right result in the Alexander case.
Yeah. And I do think he was overcharged there, but it's safe to say the federal government is pretty good at prosecuting, you know, the people that they need to prosecute. Randy, what do you do when you have a judge like Valerie Caproni who takes zero, you know what, and she reprimands the lawyers? What do? You get nervous going to court on cases like that?
I get the day, as Arthur Spatt once told me, may he rest in peace, the day I stop getting nervous, find something else to do for a living. What you do with any judge, and it doesn't matter who the judge is, you take the rulings with a poker face, you lodge your objections so you preserve your appellate record, and you stay focused and you stay determined. Yes, there are judges who have reputations of trying to take attorneys to the woodshed if you step out of lane. And if and when that happens, you take it, you make sure that you preserve your record, and you move on.
Mm. One final question, then we'll get final thoughts here. But Eric, since you're representing the victim, I just really wanted to get to a few of the victims here. You have Bella Caval. Her testimony was central to the case. She said that within minutes of having a drink at a party, she said her body began shutting down, testifying, quote, like a wave overtook my body. My whole body felt tranquilized. I couldn't move the way I wanted to move. She said she felt her body becoming heavy and literally disconnected from her mind. I felt like I was just losing control of my body. Then you've got another victim saying, I felt paralyzed. I couldn't move or fight back. I mean, eerily similar. And this victim said, I don't want their money. I just want them to not have it, saying money is their stick. So if you take it away, they can't hurt people anymore. I'm not sure what you can share about your own client, but was her experience similar to this, and how incredibly damning is it when you've got so many women saying the same thing about these three guys?
Right. I can answer that. And so there are very similar allegations to what we heard testified over and over in the criminal case, very similar to many of the allegations that my client makes in her lawsuit. Profoundly similar in a lot of different ways and a lot of different degrees. And it's a haunting thing. You know, it's a very scary thing, the way these women described their allegations of being drugged. I mean, that is a very, you try to visualize what that must feel like, to think you know what you're ingesting and to ultimately feel in a different way than you'd expect to feel than you were ingesting. And not just a different way, but a worse way, a helpless way, a confusing and a scary way. That's such a horrifying aspect to the crimes that were alleged against the Alexander brothers in the criminal case. You know, it's not just the ultimate final, unconsented sex act that was being alleged and they were convicted of, but the lead up to it and the inability to remember is something I deal with a lot of my clients. You know, the absolute physical inability to remember certain aspects of it. There starts to be a self-blame. There starts to be the questioning themselves. Did I drink too much? Was that my fault? Was I just out of control? Did I do something wrong? Was I being embarrassing, right? You get all these self-blame questions when it comes to these issues of drugging and when they ingest a drug that, you know, non-consensually. So I think that just really, really adds to the trauma of the event. It adds to the trauma of it, and it adds to the damages, you know, unfortunately, that these victims feel, many, many years and years, you know, beyond, you know, as it relates to the difficulty remembering. But it certainly was a good strategy for the prosecution to demonstrate and to highlight, of course, how consistent each witness was. Of course, we call that sort of MO evidence, modus operandi evidence, where you can really establish an MO from the defendants and how consistently they use that. That's absolutely something that the defendants did in there, excuse me, the prosecution did in this case. And I think it was very effective to show the Alexander brothers' alleged MO. And I think the jury really sort of bought into that and understood the nature of the crime that was alleged and how consistently they achieved the end goal of those crimes.
And Eric, I'm the son of a psychiatrist and a social worker. Do you encourage your clients to seek therapy? Do they do it on their own? Do you feel like it's a necessary component in their healing?
Not only do I encourage it, it's basically mandatory. I absolutely require my clients to get into therapy for their own well-being. You know, often I guess you could call it privilege to be someone who I'm often the first person that many victims tell about their abuse. I'm very proud to put that to be the case. But it is absolutely necessary for victims of traumatic crimes, to deal with the trauma of the crime. You know, do not suffer in silence. Therapists are there to help you. They can help you process the crime, process the trauma, process what you've been through, and process, help you actually heal. You know, it's one thing to accept that you're a victim, take those steps forward, but there's a whole other thing to heal, as I'm sure, you know, Dr. Johnson could back me up on that. And the healing process is so important, but also for a therapist to help navigate the trial. You know, I pride myself in my law firm on making it as therapeutic as a process as possible. But if handled incorrectly, or even sometimes if handled correctly, a civil trial against your alleged abuser can be also a traumatic thing. It can also often feel like you, the victim, are the person on trial. You get defendants get to dig very deep into your personal life. You know, when you're alleging emotional distress damages, that basically opens up a civil defense attorney, to explore other things that may have caused emotional distress damages in your life. It can be a very vulnerable thing to be also when you're accusing someone high profile like Diddy or the Alexander brothers or Jeffrey Epstein, or especially like a beloved celebrity like Diddy, or I represent an accuser of Kanye West, you're going to get very serious online backlash. People are going to call you terrible names. I tell them, never search your name on Twitter or Reddit or anything else. There's going to be really, really gross pushback and insult from the people whose beloved celebrity you are accusing of something. So for all these factors, I absolutely find it necessary for my clients and any victim, whether you are pursuing a civil lawsuit or a witness in a criminal case, to use therapy to your advantage and help you, you know, help the abuse that has been controlling you, help you begin to control that abuse.
Really well articulated. I need to follow your advice. Look at this comment right here from Maggie's Boo. to blame a specific political. This is why I shame on you, Joel, for allowing this. There is a report today that President Trump may pardon these brothers. So I asked about that. How am I blaming a party? I would like to know. You can feel free to email me. One of the big problems we have in our world today, you can't even say a name without being accused of being, there's nothing political about it. I mean, in its nature, to pardon somebody is a political move. But if the news is out there, how am I supposed to ask about it without asking? I could sign it in American Sign Language. So maybe I will learn American Sign Language and try to do a better job. But Megsy Boo Boo, tonight's not the night.
As someone who's done a lot of television interviews and representing Epstein victims, and my criticism of the way the Department of Justice has handled this entire fiasco, if you will, I certainly have had my fair share of those types of comments, those types of messages. So I'm with you on that, Joel.
Yeah, I like to I make it a point to not ignore this because I understand where she's coming from at a certain level. But it's like, if something is going on in the news, you want to report on that. It is not necessarily making a political statement. It is asking a question about it. Megsy Boo Boo. RJ, to you, final question. Are you surprised that they were convicted on all 10 counts? Two charges were dropped sort of three quarters of the way into the trial. But were you surprised it was guilty across the board? And your final thoughts here?
You know, based on what we heard, it's like we've talked about that. We had the Diddy case, which is different from this case. It's not to say that what happened in the Diddy's case was okay or anything like that. It's to say they're different cases and they both involve high profile clients. They both involve very expensive, very experienced criminal defense attorneys. But with the number of victims that came forward and the severity of the conduct and the corroborating evidence, jurors aren't necessarily, they don't generally speaking, look at things like a math problem or an equation to solve. They sit there and they kind of take it in. And when you have victim after victim and witness after witness describing really serious conduct, when they get back there, the conversation isn't, well, let's make sure that, you know, this statute applies this way to this particular offense or whatever the case may be. It's what can we do to get these guys held accountable for what happened here? So it's not necessarily shocking that this is the end result. I would say, and Randy talked about this earlier, we got the sentencing coming up. The judge made a comment after the verdict about thanking the victims for coming forward, which many judges remain silent of sentencing. She's free to make that comment. There's nothing improper about it. But what I would expect is she's going to look at that sentencing guidelines and find every single day that she can give these guys and is very likely to implement it. So be on the lookout for that in August. I expect this judge to try to give them every day that she can.
RJ, give me a rough estimate of time. I mean, we heard Randy say 22 and a half years. Do you think I think it's going to be more, but
You know, my suspicion is it's going to be more. I think the judge is really going to, based on that comment, right? It's not an inflammatory comment. She's free to make it. But thanking the victims really is a big single defense, which is that your guys are going away as long as I can make them go away. Mm.
That's not good for you guys if you're streaming STS at the Brooklyn MDC right now, Alexander Brothers. But Randy Zellin, to you, you just heard RJ mention it, sentencing August 6th. What can we expect from the defense at sentencing? Do you expect the brothers to show some sort of contrition and say, we were bad boys, please have mercy on us?
No, because to do that would effectively torpedo their appeals. So what you will see is you will see nothing from the brothers, no remorse, no contrition, no apology. You will hear very little from the defense in terms of acceptance of responsibility, all of the things that judges like to hear if they're going to, I won't say downwardly depart, but do what we call a downward variance. So in this particular instance, this case now is not about sentencing. It's going to be about the appeal.
Well, well said. And Dr. Joni Johnston, she is a forensic psychologist, friend of the show, on here often. Randy, of course, criminal defense. RJ, now doing criminal defense, former sex crimes prosecutor. But Joni, same question to you. sentencing, but on the victim side, we're going to, I assume here, victim impact statements. How tough is this? How do you prepare for this if you are the women who are now to a degree vindicated, but you're, you know, sort of forever scarred and working on, you know, just surviving in the world after this horrible set of events?
I think the victim impact statements is really an opportunity for them to have a voice that they haven't had so far. And so I think that that's going to be a really important process for them. And I totally agree about the therapy, and not just in terms of seeing that as what happened to them, but also through the trial and maybe after the trial. So that may be that getting that therapeutic support will help them, you know, in terms of navigating the victim impact statement. But I think that is going to be a healing process for them. I think being able to, again, to say things that they've thought or worried about or been concerned about for so long, and now they actually have a platform for saying that. And I'm really hoping that that's the case, because I feel like that, you know, I'm hoping that this case is going to move us one step further to shifting the blame and the shame and all the things that victims have experienced for so long where it belongs, which is not where with the victims. It's with the people who are doing these things.
Yeah. Eric, lastly to you, there was a question from Melissa Navone basically asking, you know, once judgments fall into place, if there are judgments here, and we assume that they are, that she wanted to know if it's paid by some sort of insurance entity, or if it comes right from the family's, you know, pocketbook. How devastating will this be financially for them, and your final thoughts?
I mean, hopefully, certainly for my case, absolutely financially devastating. But it really depends, to answer that question more specifically, is who you're suing. So, for instance, in the lawsuit that I filed on behalf of my client, we actually sued multiple entities. So we've sued the parents, which was, there were some questions about that. We actually have sued the parents, Ken Security, a realty company that the brothers work for. We've also sued Marriott International based on allegations we made that took place in one of the clubs in Miami Beach. At the Marriott. So technically, certainly insurance could cover some of those. When you're suing an individual like the Alexander brothers, typically it would be from their own pockets, their own wallets, their own, you know, their own, however they keep their money typically. Although sometimes there are, you know, weird ways where insurance covers it or other entities can cover it, or there's indemnification or something along those lines. But the short answer, it really depends on who you're suing. Typically individuals do not carry that type of insurance. Typically entities that you may be suing, companies, corporations, they typically do carry some level of insurance that may cover a claim. Often there's exceptions to sexual abuse or something along those lines. So it gets very complicated, but typically when you're suing an individual, you're suing them directly. And if you win or there's a settlement, that money will likely come directly out of their pockets.
Hmm. Randy, I love this question. Randy looks fancy and that he should be holding a fancy glass of wine or 100-year-old bourbon. I can smell his cologne from here. You smell great, Randy. But Randy, my question to you, this is the final question, I promise. And I just want to acknowledge Ernie Anastas for a quick second, if you guys will indulge me. There are other names in the real estate world in New York City. This is a huge case. I don't think anyone was following this closer than the people at Douglas Elliman and Corcoran and all these other big companies. How nervous do some of these names that were bandied about during the trial of these big wigs in the real estate industry who may have been up to similar shenanigans, how worried do they need to be about potential indictments coming their way?
Only if they've done something wrong and have done something within the statute of limitations. Other than that, unfortunately, one of the blessings and the curses of social media is that this stuff takes on a life of its own.
Mm. For those who don't know, this is Ernie Anastas. To say that I was shocked is an understatement. Ernie truly was one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. And Randy will attest to this, being in New York, and Eric too, absolute legend. He's been in New York news since the 70s, worked for Eyewitness News. He passed today. He was also one of the healthier 80-something-year-olds I've ever come across, walking fast. The guy literally just always had a smile on his face, zero ego, stopped and talked to absolutely everybody. Everybody knew him. New York City loved him. He passed today. I just want to play. There's a clip here. Let's play this.
most iconic news anchors of our time.
And today we're here at Central Park, 7 days after John Lennon met with a violent death. And we're listening in the background as Give Peace a Chance.
Work isn't always easy in news, and Ernie's been in the thick of our city's tough times. But no matter how devastating and disastrous an event, he always finds a way to focus on empowering people.
When I go out to report on a story or cover it, I'm always thinking about the impact that it has on an individual and a group of people. This is how I have the sensitivity of caring about it, but at the same time, putting it into perspective with a positive attitude. But somewhere along the line, there is a silver lining.
That silver lining became our 6 o'clock newscast. And Ernie was more than the anchorman, but the inspiration, pioneering a new brand of news, balancing events of the day with positive, well-meaning stories we should all be talking about.
We have to reward good behavior, the things that are happening in people's lives, the positive stories that deserve that kind of equal attention.
Attention and respect is what Ernie earned through the years with his work on and off the air, constantly engaged in communities across the city. With more than 30 Emmy Awards and nominations, he even found time to write a children's book. The mayor named March 21st Ernie Anassis Day.
That's that. One more, everybody. I'm trying to hold it together here. Luckily,
one thing about anchormen, they rarely smile. Oh, too much on their minds. Not Ernie. He's always smiling. Always. Look at him right now. I guarantee you he's smiling. And another thing about him, have you noticed? He's got the greatest collection of ties. Every one of them a thing of beauty. So what are we going to do about Ernie Onestis? He's always smiling. He has nice ties. He has a great wife and family. And besides all that, he may be the nicest guy I ever met in this business. Have a great day, everybody. And especially you, Ernie. And stop smiling for just a second. Yasu!
He and Regis were best friends. Regis no longer with us. Ernie really was. Let me just say this. We joked, like, when it was raining out, Ernie was the only guy that would not get rained on. He had a way of just stepping between the drops. He used to park his Mercedes wherever he wanted to. All the New York City cops knew who he was, never got a ticket. You may have abused that a little bit, but everyone, I mean, he was an absolute legend. And when the COE and I got married in California, I half jokingly asked him, I said, how cool would it be to have Ernie Anastas broadcasting at my wedding? And I come back and he put together a video for us that we played. And the whole theme of our wedding was broadcast news. We had like little TVs on our whatever on the plates. And Ernie, and now I need to find it. I haven't seen it, I don't think, since the wedding back in 2012. But we have lost a giant tonight in broadcasting. But much more important than that, a father, a grandfather, and just an amazing human. And if there were more Ernies and less everyone who's on X, just consider yourself one of those others. But if there were more Ernies and less people who are ego-driven on X, this world today would be a much better place. Love you all. See you tomorrow. Karma's giving me a hard time. She's refusing to do a show tomorrow. Email me some topics and I will try to get her on. But there's Corey Richens' court at 3 p.m. Eastern. Guests, stick around for 1 second.